I drill the stope all day, and you got to pull the muck out through the grizzly at night. If you're too careful, and you don't get enough muck through the grizzly, so I got an empty stoke to work with, you're in a lot of trouble, man. He gave me a knowing grin. You do that a few times, and you can collect your ticket. The diamond driller is king, and you fuck up his stope, you don't work in the mines no more, man. I remained silent. I hadn't any idea what he was talking about, but I gathered that whatever a grizzly man did, he was under all sorts of pressure, and pressure creates accidents. That's one good thing about Thomas in the School of Mines. He makes things so bloody bad in your training that if you make it and get your blasting license, you've got a good chance of staying alive on a grizzly. Donnie left me at the mine mess, where I had a room reserved for a month before I moved into a hut of my own in one of the single men's compounds surrounding the mess. I'll try to visit sometime, you hear? But up here it's not so easy. Each mining town is on its own, and you will work night shift and me always day, so it's no use for me to come over. If it gets very bad, you can call me. He scribbled the name of his mine and a phone number on a piece of paper. Just leave a message for me at the mine office. I'll come as soon as I can. He extended his hand. He was a big bloke, 6'2" or 6'3", and he had the usual Afrikaner gorilla grip. I thanked him for his help. Ach man, PK, any friend of my little booty is a friend of mine. Gert says you're a real man and will one day be a world champion. I'm glad to help. He paused. There's boxing up here also, but nobody is as good as you. Some of the Kaffirs is okay, they will be quite good to practice on. These bloody apes has got heads so hard they'd wear out the diamond drill. So long, PK. All the best, eh? I watched as the ute accelerated, skidding its wheels before moving away in a cloud of dust. Apart from the smelter and mine administration offices, the small mining town of Luanshire consisted of two parts. The town itself, which contained the married mine officials and their families, school teachers, shop owners, and colonial administration, most of whom were police, and a quite separate area for single men of several hundred small circular huts, known by the South African term rondavels. Each of these rondavels had a corrugated iron roof and walls and floor of cement. A square fly-screen veranda, 6 feet wide and 15 feet in length, was attached to each hut. While this stoop was a flimsy affair, intended to keep mosquitoes out and let a breeze in, the door to the hut was made of sheet iron, almost impossible to break down if locked from the inside. Two small windows on either side of the hut were barred. There was nothing friendly or homely about these huts, except perhaps for a large ceiling fan, which sometimes, on a blazing hot day after a night shift working a grizzly, stirred the air enough to induce a fitful sleep. The rondavel contained a bed and a mattress, a wardrobe, a table, and two chairs. In the centre of this untidy army of huts was the mess, where for a few pounds a month you ate. The block I was to live in contained men from 42 countries, many of whom had a dubious past and a doubtful future in the country from which they originated. While there were few grizzly men like myself, young guys who were fast and fit enough to work the tungsten steel grizzly bars without killing themselves, most of the miners were in their 30s, some even older. They were without exception tough, hard men who had come for the money. Few were traditional miners. Many were drunks and criminals, some of them ex-Nazis on the run, some mercenaries who had just kept moving when the war ended, waiting for another to happen, though not prepared to don a uniform for formal affairs, such as the one gathering momentum in Korea. Some were card sharps, con men and thieves, who, while working in the mines in order to remain in town, had come for the after-hours action. I learned that the normal courtesies did not apply, and not to ask a man where he came from, or to inquire into his past. He might tell you when he became soulfully or sentimentally drunk, but most of the crud, as the compound men were called by the townspeople, had learnt to keep their mouths shut, drunk or sober. I also quickly learned to keep my hut shut on a Saturday night, when the week after I'd been allocated one, I narrowly avoided being pack-raped. In a town with no women, other than a handful of married dames, The 17-year-old boy was a grand sexual opportunity for a drunken group of Germans, Russians, French Algerians and Slavs. Had I not been rescued by Rasputin, a giant Georgian who almost never spoke, I would have been bum bait for sure. While the town itself was policed, the Krud compound was on mine property and largely left alone unless a stabbing took place or a drunken brawl got out of hand. Every 6 weeks, a Belgian DC-3 would land on the small airstrip, a mile out of town near the number 9 shaft. To the cheers of the waiting Krud, it would disgorge 25 whores from Brussels via the Belgian Congo, where they had already spent a lucrative week in the copper mines of Katanga province. A couple of weeks on their backs would set them up for a year at home. Indeed, many of them were young housewives putting together the deposit for a home or shop girls earning a dowry. Europe was short of men, and a girl had to have a little more than a respectable background if she hoped to marry. Too easily explained weeks away on holiday and a pair of constantly opening legs was all it took to consolidate a proposal for marriage with the deposit, ostensibly from the bride's parents, on a nice little cottage in the suburbs of Antwerp. Some of the ladies were professional whores, because that's what some of the crud wanted. A good whore knows how to get drunk with a man, give him what he wants, and rob him of a week's wages, without disturbing his anonymity or touching his heart. A man on the run finds compassion or love or even pretended innocence his greatest source of emotional danger. The crud would wait from dawn on the day the whore flight came in, chaffing each other about getting the fresh meat and the prettiest women, cursing the bloody frog crud across the Congo border for having first go, telling each other that it was a well-established fact that frog crud have tiny pricks, and that's why the women went there first. They would tell each other with winks and guffaws that had it been the other way round, the bloody frogs would have ended up getting it for nothing because the whores wouldn't have known they'd been on the job. The whores were known as French letters because the frog crud had first dipped their pens in and then sent them by airmail across the border. The Congo miners were a mixed lot, just like the Copper Belt, though the majority were Belgian who spoke French, but the distinction escaped most of the crud. If he speaks French, he's a frog, so who's going to argue? My new life began in the School of Mines, a school conducted mostly underground on day shift at Number 9 Shaft, which stood on the end of town. It was run by two large Welshmen, who it was claimed played together in the front row for Cardiff before the war. Di Thomas and Gareth Jones were a remarkable duo, with Thomas working underground with the class, and Jones, an ex-schoolteacher and the mine technical officer, taking the 2-hour theoretical class before our 8-hour underground shift began. The combination was worked to extract the maximum agony out of the 3 months spent in their care. Jones would feed Thomas the weaknesses of each member of the class, and Thomas would exploit these for all he was worth when we arrived underground. They saw themselves as being in the practical business of showing men how to stay alive underground, and they damn near killed them in the process. At 17 I was the youngest, and also physically the smallest, of as tough a collection of reluctant students as ever assembled to learn anything. We had all come for the money and not for the career, but the Northern Rhodesian Department of Mines required that all miners obtain their blasting license, a process which required that we learn not only how to use dynamite, but that we were trained as lashers, timbermen, drillers and pipe fitters. The first 2 months were physically the hardest of my life. At £130 I was not designed for the kind of work required. This was not South Africa, and Thomas demanded that the men under him do all the work normally done by African miners. The back-breaking labour of drilling and lashing a freshly blasted haulage could bring grown men to total exhaustion, and many a time to the point of mutiny. Thomas was remorseless. Lashing was the process of removing blasted rock by hand and shovel and loading it into underground trucks. This we performed 6 hours a day, every day for the first month, often in narrow haulages 1,000 feet underground, in temperatures of 100 degrees. The 8-hour underground shift allowed half an hour for lunch and a 5-minute water break every hour. Years of boxing had conditioned my arms and upper body, and I quickly learnt the rhythm of working a blunt-nosed, long-handled miner's shovel. But by the end of a shift, I was buckling at the knees and blubbing from exhaustion. Thomas heckled the men with invective, constantly trying to provoke a fight, trying to make a man lose his head and have a go at him. One or two tried, and apart from receiving a thrashing, were expelled from the school, their chance at the big money gone forever. I longed to take Thomas on. No one knew I was a boxer, and when I was not too exhausted and could dream a little, I fantasized about him throwing punches at me, missing hopelessly, and finally falling exhausted on the ground, having been made a monkey of in front of the crud. In my daydream I would leave him groveling on the ground while I quietly picked up my long-handled shovel and continued lashing the end without saying a word. Just the knowledge that I could probably manage to do this in real life kept me going when he baited me, sometimes without let-up for an hour at a time.
"Okay, shit for brains. You're so fucking smart. How much gelignite is required to blast the 12-hole end?"
In the first week I had read the textbooks Gareth Jones had issued to us cover to cover, and Thomas soon discovered that I knew the answers to the simple questions he threw at us when we went underground each day. He didn't like a smart-ass in his class, and seemed determined to get me. He would ask questions which appeared in the books weeks ahead of our learning them, but I usually knew the answer. The rest of the crud were not known for their brains, and reading isn't generally a strong point among such men. I knew I couldn't goof the answer just to satisfy Thomas's need to put me in my place. The crud derived enormous pleasure from my getting the answers right, and therefore in their minds getting the better of Thomas.
"6-foot drills or 9, sir?" I'd ask. "You being a smart-ass boy, yo!"
"No, sir, but it would make a difference, wouldn't it?"
"Of course, you half-wit. Of course it would make a difference."
"Well, that's why I asked, Mr. Thomas." Caught in his own verbal trap, Thomas would answer angrily,
"We don't use too many 9-foot Chakama drills now, do we?"
"If the rock is a bit cakey, we do, sir," I answered. Thomas would jump up in glee.
"There's precious little cakey rock in a fucking copper mine, boyo."
"In that case, 18 pounds, sir," I would answer smoothly. The men around me would wear smiles as big as watermelon slices.
"Correct!"
Thomas would yell.
"But don't you be a smart-ass with me, boyo, or you'll be lashing ends until your arms fall off, and you have to use your shoulder stumps to pick your nose."
"Yes, sir," I'd say. But I knew he would have the last say, moving me over to a badly blasted end where the ore had broken in large lumps too big for a shovel, so that I had to break and lift the rock all day until I collapsed from exhaustion.
"No more lingering, boyo. Back on the job in 5 minutes or you'll find a quid."
In the School of Mines we were paid a token salary, which just covered the cost of the hut and our mess bill with a couple of quid over for essentials. If by the end of the month you were down 5 pounds, it made things tough. I told myself that nothing Thomas said or did could wear me down. I convinced myself that the hard work was why I'd come. And indeed, after 2 months in the School of Mines, my body had never been harder, and I knew the muscle bulk would soon begin to follow. While I kept a speedball and a punching bag in my hut where it wouldn't be noticed, and worked out every day with weights in the club gym, as well as doing 5 or 6 miles of road work 3 times a week, I made no attempt to join the boxing club. Sport was the one thing both miners and good citizens shared, and the club, heavily subsidized by the mines, was the social center of the small town. The club affected all the traditions and mannerly ways Anglophile institutions of this sort demand from lower middle-class members, who find themselves fortuitously thrust into the upper echelons of a colonial backwater society. And it solved the problem of having to accommodate the multinational crud by building a separate bar for them. This was in a separate building from the club, with its own entrance, where the men could come without being seen by the town establishment, mine officials, and the more acceptable of the miners' families. The crud bar, as it was known, contained a 50-foot bar counter, cement floor, and white lavatory tiles 6 feet up the walls. It also featured swing doors like a western saloon. The bar room itself was empty and permitted standing room only. Outside was a beer garden with 100 tables or so, each one sporting a permanent tin umbrella welded into the center of a steel table, which in turn was bolted onto the painted green cement yard. The chairs, too, were made of steel, their legs permanently bolted to the cement. Each table and six chairs were painted a different colour, so that from a distance it all looked very gay. Above the tables, suspended like tall washing lines, were strings of coloured lights, which at night gave a weird sort of green and mauve cast to everything. Three barmen, all Germans, all called Fritz, and all fat, worked the bar like an ordnance office. Each Fritz operated his third of the bar, and behind him was a complete stock of liquor and a cash register. He never left his own territory to pour a drink, draw a beer, or make change. Each Fritz was known by a number, Fritz 1, Fritz 2, and Fritz 3. Each had a crud following, whom he came to regard as regular to his part of the bar. The Fritzes boasted there wasn't a drink in the world they didn't have or couldn't make. But mostly they served brandy, beer, rum, and vodka, in that order. If you did your drinking standing in the bar, you could get your liquor served by the measure and your beer by the glass. If you wished to sit outside, you got a jug of beer or bought a full bottle of spirits, unless you wanted to keep fighting your way back into the bar for single serves. No Fritz was ever known to move from behind the long bar. The crud bar stayed open from 7 a.m. until midnight, when one Fritz would hose it out, removing at the same time the crud too inebriated to leave on their own. During the day until 3 o'clock, when the day shift ended, the three Fritz wives, each one as big as her husband, worked the crud bar. They were known as Mrs. Fritz collectively and remained unnumbered. Husband and wife, it seemed, never got together, and it was a source of constant wonder among the crud that the Fritzes between them boasted 15 fat blonde children. At the end of 3 months, only 11 of the 18 men who joined the School of Mines with me remained. We were eligible to take our blasting license, choosing either the International or Northern Rhodesian versions. Thomas, in a rare show of kindness, suggested that I sit for the International, as he hadn't had a student pass the International in 7 years. "If you pass, you'll be the youngest ever, which would be a feather in Mr. Jones's cap, and I might even have a pat on the back myself, boyo." The rugby season had begun, and Thomas had discovered, too late to be of any use to me, that I could play, and in the trials looked like I could make the first team, of which he and Jones were selectors. The examination was held at the office of the Department of Mines in Ndola. It consisted of a half-hour written examination and an hour of verbals. This was because many of the men were not much good at writing, but could answer most of the questions put to them directly. Most of the guys with me were frightened to the point of paralysis. If you failed, you returned to the school for another month, and failure after that and you were out of the mines. I had been coaching them for the last month, and had come to be known as Professor PK. On the bus into Ndola, I fired endless questions at them. All but a huge Boer from the Orange Free State obtained their blasting license. The Boer, a likable enough bloke but thick as mahogany, was out forever, but cheered himself up with the knowledge that he had been accepted as a stoker on Northern Rhodesian Railways. Thomas and Jones had followed us to Ndola by car, and after the morning's examination, we'd all repaired to Ndola's only hotel, where just about everyone got very drunk and ended up telling Thomas what a good old bastard he was. I had passed the international license and must have consumed a gallon of lemon squash just responding to the toasts the men kept proposing to Thomas, Jones, and Professor Piquet. The more drunk they became, the more effusive, until towards the end Thomas had become a certain candidate for sainthood, and they all swore that they would protect me against all comers, and that there was nothing I couldn't ask them for. My life as a grizzly man commenced the next day, when I went underground for the first time on my own, on the 11-7 shift. The workings of a grizzly need to be briefly explained. Imagine, if you will, a funnel pointing downwards towards the ground. The top bit of the funnel, before it narrows down to the spout, is the stope, which is in fact a huge underground hole. The spout from it is used for getting the rock, blasted off the sides of the hole, out of the hole. This spout is 60 feet long and leads directly to a main haulage. The bottom of the funnel spout is fitted with a steel door worked with compressed air. Halfway down it, that is 30 foot from the main haulage and the same distance from the beginning of the stope, A set of 6 tungsten steel bars are fitted across the funnel spout, with a narrow walkway cut sideways into the rock leading to it. These 6 tungsten bars are known as the Grizzly. The reason for this name being that tungsten bars were made in Canada, hence Grizzly Bars. The ore drilled and blasted from the sides of the stope by the diamond drillers is funneled down the spout at the bottom of the stope and comes rushing down, with the smaller bits falling through the Grizzly Bars, filling the bottom half of the funnel spout. The bigger bits fall onto the bars and need to be blasted through them into a suitable size for loading onto the trucks in the main haulage. Underground trains pull up to the compressed air door, and operators standing on the main haulage open the door at the end of the funnel and fill the trucks with ore. It's really a very simple operation, but also a very dangerous one. The Grizzly Man works the bars which are directly under the mouth of the stope, which is capable of disgorging rocks the size of small motor cars without warning. The Grizzly Man works in the dark. His miner's lamp, attached to his hard hat, with the battery clipped to his webbing belt, is the only source of light. He has 5 Africans to help him lash the rock through the Grizzly Bars and to prepare mud for the explosives. Occasionally he will get the muck flowing from the stope, and it will continue to run all night, with only an occasional blast or a little work on the bars with long crowbars to keep it going. But mostly it's gut-wrenching work, laying charges and working ore through the bars, sometimes as many as 40 or 50 blasts a night, until a powder headache caused by the sweet, sickly-smelling gelignite sticks threatens to tear your head off your shoulders. Only diamond drillers, who use more gelignite than grizzly men, get worse powder headaches, sometimes being reduced to a state of unconsciousness or temporary insanity by the terrible pain. A grizzly man works on the actual bars, which are about 6 inches thick and 2 feet apart. Safety rules require that he be attached to a 20-foot chain, which clips to the back of his webbing belt. But the chain, like so many safety procedures, is a catch-22. If he slips and falls through the bars into the bottom half of the funnel, his back will snap like a piece of celery, as his fall is broken by the chain some 15 feet below the bars. If he doesn't break his back and the muck starts to run, the ore coming through the bars would tear him into mince. A good grizzly man takes his chances on the bars without a safety chain, and learns, even in the dark, to be as agile as a monkey, jumping from bar to bar all night, carrying a 5-foot steel crowbar in his hands. Grizzly men always work the same grizzly, knowing their lives depend on their intimate knowledge of the character of the stope and the funnel. Each grizzly has a personality of its own, and a good grizzly man can read his grizzly as though his mind is tuned into the very rock it's made from. A slight leaking of pebble in a hang-up, and he knows to run for safety, as 100 tons of rock is about to come down directly over his head. The wrong pitch in an echo from the stope, and he knows a single rock may come hurtling through to smash him off the bars. His reactions are as fine-tuned as those of a top racing car driver, and his adrenaline pumps all night. At the end of a shift, a grizzly man will have lost 4 or 5 pounds in weight, and will be in a state of total exhaustion. At the end of 3 months, he is taken off grizzlies for a spell of 2 months, before he is allowed to return. While the money was enormous, most grizzly men elected not to return, and took a lower-paid job as a pipe fitter, timber man, or ganger. One particular job on the grizzly led to the final unnerving of even the most courageous of men. Sometime during most shifts, and often 3 or 4 times, the rock would become blocked at the mouth of the stope. That is, at the very top of the funnel, some 30 feet above the grizzly bars. In mining terms, this was known as a hang-up, or a bunch of grapes. Rocks of every size jammed the mouth of the stope. The safety procedure required to dislodge the rock and get the stope flowing again was to make up a parcel of gelignite. This is then tied to the end of a 30-foot bamboo pole. The sticks of explosive are then wrapped with cordtex, which is explosive made into a cord which looks like white electrical flecks. The idea is to push the parcel of gelignite against the rocks jamming the mouth of the stope. Then to light the fuse attached to the end of the cordtex, which has been trailed from the parcel of gelignite to the level of the grizzly. Whereupon, if you're very lucky, the blast against the hang-up hopefully dislodges the rocks, causing the mouth of the stope to open again and the muck to flow. But life on a grizzly isn't meant to be easy, and dynamite or gelignite, when it is not sealed with a mud pack, blasts outwards away from the rock, taking the line of least resistance. Blasting a hang-up with the bamboo pole technique is seldom successful. The pressure on the grizzly man is enormous. He must get the muck flowing, and using the bamboo pole technique, he could blast away unsuccessfully all night. He is paid by the truckload, and if he doesn't empty his stope, the diamond driller will lose his day shift, which often results in a grizzly man losing a couple of teeth. Apart from all this, the grizzly man's pride is involved. A grizzly man who leaves a grizzly hung up is the lowest form of life in a mine. As Thomas would say, "It's just not fucking done, boyo." After successfully trying to bring a hang-up down with a bamboo pole bomb, the grizzly man fills the front of his thick woolen miner's shirt with mud and a gelignite bomb strung with cortex, and scales the sheer face of the funnel until he reaches the hang-up. This is the dangerous part. If the hang-up comes down while he is fixing the explosive against it, the grizzly man is dead, thrown 60 feet down through the bars to be buried under 50 tons of rock. Fighting the panic of being totally committed with nowhere to go, you find a jamming point between the rocks and insert the gelignite bomb. Then you wind the cortex around it and let enough cortex fall to the grizzly below so that you can attach a fuse to it. Finally, you seal the bomb with mud to make it airtight so that the blast will go inwards into the rock. Having set it and packed it, you then have to come down again, each precarious step up and down the sheer face of the funnel, a gamble that the hang-up will hold. Back at the grizzly level, you connect the cortex to a fuse, signal the African to blow the warning hooter, light the fuse with a cheeser stick, a flare the size of a thick pencil, which once lit cannot be extinguished. Then you have 30 seconds to retire into the safety tunnel before the blast goes off. If the hang-up still doesn't come down, you're forced up again, aware that with the added blast it could be teetering and on the point of crashing down. You soon learn to make only one trip up the funnel, laying several blasts across the face of the hang-up and stringing them together with cortex. This means you spend 10 or 15 minutes up against the hang-up, with each second increasing the tension and the danger. But this way, when the 4 or 5 bombs go off simultaneously, you have a good chance of bringing the hang-up down. It all depends on nerve. Yours. If you have the nerve to stay up the funnel for 15 or 20 minutes, carefully laying a blast pattern and sealing each bomb with mud, it takes a very big hang-up to defeat you. In the year I was to work grizzlies, 5 of the 20 grizzly men working the mine were killed when a hang-up gave way while they were up the funnel laying charges against it. Mine rules did not permit grizzly men to climb up into the mouth of the stope. Caught doing it meant instant dismissal. But because you were forced to at least twice during a shift, the shift boss would stay away from the grizzly level so that he wouldn't catch you. Everyone's copper bonus depended on the grizzly man getting the ore out of the stope. No shift boss would police the rules when he knew that the bamboo pole technique was so ineffectual that a hang-up might remain all night and not a ton of ore would be moved out of the stope. When I wasn't shitting myself, I took a perverse pride in being a successful grizzly man. I was the youngest in the mine with one of the best ore tallies. The diamond driller who worked the stope above my grizzly was an Afrikaner called Borta, whom I never met, as he worked day shift and I worked night. The diamond drillers were the underground elite, and never spoke to the grizzly men personally. The work was too dangerous, and a driller didn't want the responsibility of knowing who was working his stope. But if you kept your ore tally up and his stope empty, he would send you a case of brandy at the end of each month. A case of brandy from your diamond driller was the badge of honor every grizzly man worked for. In the crazy crud world of the Central African copper mines, it became an approbation even more important than money. I gave the brandy to Rasputin, the giant Georgian who lived in the hut next to me. Rasputin worked as a timberman on the same night shift as I did, and we cycled to Number 7 shaft about 3 miles out of town where we both worked. From the night he had saved my rear-end virginity, we had been friends, our friendship based less on words than on the things we shared. Rasputin spoke very little English, and rather than learn any more, he simply didn't talk. He'd sit on my stoop, or I on his, and we'd play chess. He was a good enough player to keep me interested, and if I lost concentration, he would sometimes take a game. Often we would simply sit, and I would read a book, or he'd play his collection of Tchaikovsky symphonies and concertos on his new portable record player. He never played anything but Tchaikovsky, and would sit with a huge block of native timber in one hand and a kindling axe in the other, and without ever releasing the block of wood, he would chip away until 3 hours later it became a perfect ball. Rasputin was almost as tall as Doc had been, but he was twice as broad, even bigger than the Afrikaners, and the axe would have weighed 5 pounds. The act of carving the block of wood into a ball was one which took almost unimaginable strength. When Rasputin wasn't carving a ball, he was sharpening the axe. He would work away to the music, going through the entire repertoire of concertos and of the three symphonies. Sometimes silent tears would roll down his cheeks and spill into his shaggy beard. These he never bothered to wipe away, but he simply continued to carve at the block of wood, occasionally putting down the axe long enough to pick up a tin mug filled with VSOP brandy, which he would half empty in one gulp and then refill to the brim. When Tchaikovsky came to an end, which meant sitting through all three of his piano concertos and his violin concerto and at least three symphonies, mostly his number one in G minor, two in C minor, and always ending with his sixth, the grand and brilliant pathetique, a bottle of Botta's brandy would be empty, and the wooden ball would be complete. Rasputin would carefully pack away the record player, dust the records and slip them into their jackets, and lay them on top of a towel in an old suitcase. Then he would take the wooden ball and add it to a pile on the floor inside his hut. There must have been 600 or 700 of these, about the size of a bowling ball, stacked in separate heaps of about 100 each, one ball added each day. Some of the older ones had turned a lovely silver-grey colour, and others bore beautiful markings from the native timber he used. Each ball was identically sized and beautifully made. You could pick up two carved months apart, and their perfect roundness and size were so close the eye couldn't pick out the difference, each ball a testament to his enormous skill and strength. His hut smelled of the sap of young timber, not unlike the smell of a forest. Rasputin would step into his hut and take a deep breath, inhaling the sappy odor of the uncured native timber.
"Smell like Russia, Piki."
I often wondered if in his native Russia he had once lived amongst the birch forests of the Taiga, but I could think of no way of asking him. I became fascinated by the beautifully carved balls, and found that I could hold the axe in position to work a piece of wood for no more than 3 minutes before the hand holding the wood would no longer function, and the pain in my right wrist from holding the axe became unbearable. I realized that the exercise involved would strengthen my arms, wrists, and even my hands for boxing. So I purchased a smaller and lighter axe, and Rasputin sharpened it for me until it was like a razor. The idea that I wished to emulate him gave the huge bear of a man great pleasure. We'd sit on his veranda whittling away, listening to Mr. Tchaikovsky, Rasputin drinking brandy and shedding tears which fell like drops of liquid silver down his cheeks to disappear into his huge black beard. Eventually I worked out that the wooden balls were Rasputin's calendar, one ball for each day he had spent in the mines. By my reckoning, he had been there about 3 years. We would meet after our shift came up at 7 a.m. and cycle back to the mess for breakfast. Rasputin would always be showered and waiting for me as my cage came up from underground. Somehow he managed to finish his shift early and get up to the surface before the grizzly men.
"Much muck move, Piki. You good boy,"
he would say without fail, as I stepped out of the cage. Then he would take my miner's lamp from me and put it on charge in the battery room, so that I could go straight to the shaft office, check my ore tally, sign off, and quickly get to the showers. When I emerged from the change rooms 20 minutes later, he would be standing outside in the morning sunlight with my bicycle, ready for a quick getaway. I'd been off grizzlies for only a week after having done my 3 months, when the mine captain called me into his office and asked me to volunteer to go back on. I was supposed to be rested with a main haulage job, such as bossing a gang of lashers, but three grizzly men had been badly injured, and the mine had no replacements coming out of the School of Mines. The incentive was to double my copper bonus for the period I was back on grizzlies. It seems Borta the diamond driller had been screaming about the new grizzly man on his stope and wanted me back. The money and the compliment were too much for me. Youth has a strong sense of its own immortality, and I was no different from most. I found myself back at my grizzly platform for another 3 months. At the end of the month, 2 cases of brandy arrived from Borta, which made Rasputin completely independent of the Krudbar. He was so proud of me, he started to cry. Lashing a case of brandy to the carrier on each of our bikes, we pushed them the 3 miles to town, the 24 bottles in each case clinking merrily as we steered the bikes over the corrugated dirt road. When we arrived at the Krud compound, he put the cases in his hut and emerged moments later carrying an ancient 12-bore shotgun.
"Tonight, Russian stew," he announced.
Rasputin's rabbit stew was his highest compliment, and I must say it really was delicious. A thick broth, flavored with strange herbs he gathered in the wild, and delicious chunks of pink rabbit meat, served with tiny whole onions and potatoes. I watched as he headed for the bush, not even waiting to have his breakfast at the mess. I rose at 4 in the afternoon as usual. From Rasputin's hut came the delicious smell of the rabbit stew. I knew he would call me in about 5:30 to eat, so I headed off to the shower block to do my ablutions. We would eat and then attend a movie at the club. It was Wednesday night, and Wednesday was always a Western. Rasputin loved Westerns with a passion. We would arrive early and sit in the front row, Rasputin with a bottle of brandy and his mug, ready to shout and scream and wave his fists at the baddies on the screen. He would weep when the hero was in a tight spot, about to be burnt by Indian braves or tortured by malicious outlaws. Finally, when the film reached its climax, and the hero emerged unscathed and triumphant with the girl, he would stand up and bang his mug against the empty brandy bottle and shout his approbation in Russian. Nobody seemed to mind. Rasputin was part of the Wednesday Western, and he'd always buy sweets and ice cream at the interval for all the kids. It became a tradition to yell and scream and pretend to cry at all the places Rasputin did, and a grand time was had by all. At 5:30 I heard his bellow.
"PK, you come!"
Rasputin had placed 2 bowls on the table, and beside them were 2 large spoons. Arranged in a jam tin in the center of the table were wildflowers he had gathered when he was out rabbit hunting, and beside the flowers rested a round loaf of fresh bread. The flowers were a nice homely touch, and the stew in a large pot on his single electric burner smelt wonderful. Rasputin poured it straight from the pot into the bowls. The delicious broth came steaming up at me. He dipped into the pot with a fork, stabbing chunks of pink rabbit meat and placing them in my bowl. Finally he produced a bottle of lemonade for me, and filling his tin mug with brandy, we tucked in, tearing huge hunks of bread from the loaf and slurping hungrily at the delicious stew. Neither of us said a word until it was all eaten and we'd had a second helping.
"Russian stew, very delicious, Rasputin," I said finally, rubbing my tummy to emphasize my satisfaction.
Rasputin looked pleased, even a little embarrassed at the compliment. He rose from the table, and walking over to the wardrobe, withdrew from it the ancient 12-bore shotgun. Pretending to aim at an imaginary rabbit in the distance, he squinted down the barrel.
"Oh, Piqué! Rabbit go meow, meow! Me go boom, boom! Rabbit kaput!"
He laughed uproariously and put the shotgun back into his cupboard. I had never eaten a cat before, but I knew there was no way I would be able to refuse Rasputin next time he paid me his supreme compliment and went rabbit hunting again. I quietly prayed that I wouldn't do anything in the future that would please him too much. I wondered silently which of the town families was wondering what had happened to their cat. 24. It is the human experience, particularly true of the young, that all routine, no matter how bizarre, soon becomes normal procedure. Just as the survivors of the Nazi concentration camps talk of the routines imposed and followed, which measure the days of horror until they seem the normal passages of life, working a grizzly became a job as unexceptional as any other. Boldness, at first a stranger to be treated with caution, soon becomes a friend, then partner, and finally is taken for granted, as is the daily relationship between 2 married people. There comes a stage when the nervous system adjusts to accommodate the new environment, in which a former state of anxiety becomes one of calm, and situations which formerly brought a rush of adrenaline through the blood leave it calmly going about the business of supplying the heart. A good grizzly man attracts a good black gang. Africans stripped from the bush instinctively understand the group security a confident leader brings. As the months went by, and my grizzly remained accident-free and I unscathed, those blacks who worked regularly with me would seldom stay away sick, preferring to shiver through a bout of malaria rather than take a chance of losing their place to another black anxious to work in a juju or mystically protected gang. When a grizzly man blew himself up, it was not unusual for him to take his number one boy with him. The number one is the most experienced mine boy in the gang, usually a second-timer. Better paid than the rest of the crew, he acts as black leader as well as right-hand man to the grizzly man. It is he who handles the charges and prepares the mud packs to bed down the explosives. If an accident occurs, he is generally working close to his grizzly man. Knowing this, a good grizzly man will generally dismiss his number one to the safety shaft to man the blast warning siren before he lights the fuse. And a good number one will repay his grizzly man by building the mystique of the grizzly man in the eyes of the bush Africans who make up the rest of the gang. Once a gang has been associated with an accident on the grizzly level, they become bad juju in their own eyes and in the eyes of the other black miners. It was inconceivable to these primitive bush Africans that a superior white man should die and that a thoroughly expendable black one should live. The gods had quite obviously made a mistake. The stick lightning had been meant for them. The mark of death was upon them if they remained in the mines. Black miners did not understand or believe in the concept of increasing odds, and would have been quite unable to grasp the simple logic which dictated that the longer I remained working grizzlies, the more likely I was to come unstuck. The superstition which held them to me is understandable in a simple mind. The fact that I began to half-believe it was not. With the exception of a week's break after my first 3 months on grizzlies, I had been working for 9 months. While I knew that simply by requesting to do so I could be relieved, I hung on. Porter's 2 cases of the best South African brandy continued to arrive for Rasputin at the end of every month, and the fact that the ore tally pulled from my grizzly almost always headed the night's tally list did important things for my ego, though I would probably not have admitted this even to myself. Even in this unlikely environment, I still hadn't conquered the need to be the best. Though the odds had grown well beyond simple foolishness, I convinced myself that my brains, ha-ha, were the difference, that I knew how to survive a grizzly because I could read it better, and was less likely to make emotional decisions under pressure, which was, of course, a load of codswallop. I had reached the point where Fats Greer, who drove the number 7 shaft hoist, and who also acted as the mine's part-time insurance agent, refused to give me cover.
For fuck's sake, PK, the all-time record for a grizzly stand is 11 months, and the bastard who had it is pushing up daisies. Stop being a smart-ass.
But I was through doing what other people wanted, and I told myself that if the copper bonus held and I could stay on grizzlies for a year, I would have earned enough to put myself through Oxford. No more emotional handouts for me. I could pay my own way. My whole life had been a testament to using the human resources around me, to winning against the odds. If I understood the system as I felt I did, I was no longer willing to pay the emotional price it demanded from me. If this was only in my own mind, well, every man is an island, and at the same time also Robinson Crusoe, you're on your own and must learn to fend for yourself. The year of despair I had spent as a 5-year-old in the hands of the judge had tainted everything I had subsequently done. My childlike notion of camouflage to avoid being emotionally besieged had persisted. In my mind, although I'm certain at the time I would not have been able to articulate the idea, the mines represented a return to the fear of that first boarding school. But this time it was I who would win. The grizzly I worked would be the judge, but this time I would not be broken. I had come to the mines to find out who the hell I really was. It is curious that in the retelling of a dangerous situation, the explanation is often made to include a premonition of the disaster, whereas in truth most accidents strike like a viper of lightning from an apparently clear blue sky. It is as though human beings like to pump up the importance of a near escape, or even a catastrophe, by placing the hand of destiny at the helm of calamity. The day before the grizzly got me, I dreamt I was bent over a routine charge to light a fuse. A normal length of fuse is designed to take 2 minutes to reach the dynamite charge, but for a routine explosion of rock resting on the grizzly bars, a good grizzly man will cut the fuse to a burn through of 30 seconds, which is enough time to get into the safety shaft. During a single underground shift, on a hard night when the muck refuses to run, A grizzly man can make 40 or 50 separate rock blasts. With a saving of 90 seconds for most of these, he can easily cull an extra hour's tally from the shift. In ore terms, this can make a considerable difference to the night's final tally. In my dream, I held the lighted cheeser stick to the fuse, waiting for the familiar kick of sparks to indicate that it was alight. But the fuse turned instead into the black mamba of the Crystal Cave of Africa. It rose as it had done outside the cave, its head weaving and its darting tongue becoming the spluttering sparks of the lighted fuse. Mesmerized, I was unable to move until I realized it was too late. I jabbed the cheeser stick at the head of the snake as it struck. The lighted stick of sulfur blended with the explosion as I was blown to smithereens. I awoke, my heart pounding furiously. Grizzly men often talked of the dreams. When the dreams come, it's time to quit. I had not dreamt before, and now I was afraid. The grizzlies had started to invade my subconscious. That night I told the shift boss I wanted off and gave him a week's notice. He didn't question me but simply nodded and said, "You earned it, PK. We'll give you a soft option, maybe lashing on a main haulage, eh?" I thanked him, but he suddenly looked alarmed. "Shit, who's going to tell Borta? He thinks you're Jesus Christ." He grinned. "Someone else can tell the son of a bitch. That's the day shift's job." While I had received two cases of brandy regularly for the past 5 months, I had not met Borta. As I mentioned, it was a tradition that a diamond driller and his grizzly man didn't meet. Nobody seemed to know quite why this was, but like most time-worn behavior, it had turned into a superstition, and both men would go to some pains never to meet while they worked in conjunction with each other. "Rasputin will miss the brandy," I said, conscious that now that I had made the decision to quit, a weight had lifted from my mind. The shift boss laughed. "You can bloody well tell him that." Rasputin was the best timberman in the mine, but the scourge of shift bosses, whom he wouldn't allow near his work site when he was building a bulk end or timbering a new haulage. But they had all come to accept Rasputin. What he did well, without taking unnecessary chances with his gang. That was the first rule of mining. The rest was simply the niceties of deferring to authority, a concept the huge Georgian seemed not to understand. There was nothing exceptional about the first part of the shift following my talk with the shift boss. I stopped to rest my gang as usual between 3 and 4 in the morning, the time known everywhere men work underground as Dead Man's Hour. It is the time when the human pulse is said to regulate by running slow, and the circadian rhythm to falter. It is the time, old-timers insist, when the bad accidents happen. To work through Dead Man's Hour would be sorely to tempt fate. While we are meant to be rational humans, there lurks in each of us a covert superstition, which probably began when man worshipped rocks and trees, and which we ignore at our own peril. For the grizzly man, better the hour saved by cutting fuses short than one used when death stalks the dark underground tunnels at the same time every night. At 4:15 I completed laying the mud pack over a routine charge, cutting the fuse short as usual. I had inserted it under the mud-covered gelignite and took the lighted cheeser stick from the number one boy, whom I called Elijah because he liked to light the cheeser stick himself, forfeiting his chance to retire to the safety of the escape shaft. He waited with me until the fuse began to splutter. With the cheeser stick Elijah handed me, I touched the notched and splayed end I'd cut to reveal the granules of black gunpowder which ran through the body of the fuse. Nothing happened. No flare as the gunpowder caught. No familiar splutter as it tore down the center of the fuse. Even before I could question the reason, the vision of the black mamba filled my mind's eye. "Christ! It can't be. It's a running fuse." A running fuse is when a fuse burns inwards and appears from the outside to be inert, while in fact it is moving just as quickly towards the charge of gelignite. It is extremely rare. Most grizzly men have never seen one, or if they have, haven't lived to tell the story. I grabbed Elijah by his shirt collar and propelled him toward the safety shaft, tackling him the last few feet into the shaft as I dived for safety, a split second before the charge went off. The explosion roared 15 feet from where we lay. Had the snake not returned to me in my dream, I might have persisted with the shortened fuse. 3 seconds longer, and Elijah of the Burning Bush and I would have been history. Rising to his knees and dusting his hands on the seat of his trousers, Elijah started to babble with excitement as the rest of the gang came running towards us. He told them how Devil Fuse, which did not light, had set off the charge, but how I had known of its magic and thwarted its evil intention by pulling him to safety. The gang listened with open-mouthed astonishment. Then each in turn came over to me and touched my arm, dropping their eyes as they did so. Once again I had confirmed my magical status. Was this not yet more proof that their collective safety was assured? The tadpole angel was back at work again. I am forced to admit I too felt hugely elated by the experience, enchanted with the meaning of the dream. I kept asking myself whether I would otherwise have recognized a running fuse. It was a mining occurrence so rare, Thomas hadn't even mentioned its possibility in the School of Mines. I had seen it noted briefly before being dismissed as extremely unusual in one of the numerous textbooks we'd been issued. A textbook possibly only I amongst the class would have taken the trouble to read. Instead of seeing the near disaster as a real-life warning, I became so elated I decided to withdraw my notice to quit Grizzlies. I felt a tremendous sense of my own destiny, of the rightness of the path I had chosen. I had gambled and won. My slate was wiped clean. The accident designed to happen had been thwarted. The original odds were once again restored. I would see this old bitch Grizzly through until the 15th of February, 1 week over 11 months to the day. Screw Fats Greer, I'd make it a new record. I admit to the unsoundness of my reasoning, but it wasn't all stupidity. The pay for a soft option job on a main haulage was less than half the amount I was receiving each month working at Grizzly. With my double copper bonus, as well as my tally bonus, I could add another 40% to this as well. Giving all this up would mean staying on at the mines another 3 months, and by doing so, missing the commencement term at Oxford. Feeling good all over, I walked up to the Grizzly, and standing on the bars, shone my lamp up at the hang-up, which had developed at the mouth of the stope. It looked unsafe, a bunch of grapes where the loosening of one small rock might bring the lot down. 50 tons of rock could be held suspended above my head by a mere pebble. The old bitch was playing with me, teasing me, my ears strained to hear her talk. A creak, a moan, the echoed clatter of a single pebble. So I might read the constraint of the rock avalanche poised above my head. It came at last. The sudden, sharp, erratic clatter of a single rock as it broke free from the hang-up, to ricochet against the steeply funneled rock sides leading from the stope. 1, 2. It would take 3 bounces before landing on the Grizzly bar furthest from where I stood. My intimate, almost instinctive knowledge, brought about from working more than 2,000 hours on this one Grizzly, told me the rock was about the size of a large grapefruit, and that it almost certainly preceded the collapse of the hang-up. I moved fast, leaping instinctively across the bars towards the protection of the safety shaft. Above me the hang-up groaned momentarily, a second or two's warning before the roaring avalanche followed. My feet had already left the bars in the final leap to safety when the single rock hit the Grizzly and, bouncing erratically off the tungsten steel bar, flew through the air to hit me in the stomach. The roar of the rock breaking free reached my ears before I was knocked unconscious through the bars, to fall 60 feet down the almost empty shaft. The fall should have killed me. The 10 tons of rock which followed me through the bars should also have done so. I had been unconscious the moment the rock struck me, and had fallen through the bars like a sack of potatoes, bouncing against one wall of the downshaft. My hard hat had miraculously stayed on and prevented my head from being smashed in as I landed in about 3 feet of fine shale at the bottom of the Grizzly. The shale had been the result of the huge rock I had blasted through the bars with the running fuse. I had been conscious at the time of using too much gelignite, but the Grizzly shaft below the bars had been empty, and a good Grizzly man tries to put a buffer of fine shale against the pneumatic steel doors to protect them from the effect of bigger rocks smashing against them. I had landed in this soft bed of shale and sand, my body rolling and finally wedging under a narrow shelf of rock where the side of the shaft had been carelessly blasted. 10 tons of rock from the hang-up had followed me through the bars, covering my body and building up over me, though miraculously in pieces big enough to allow some air to reach me. I lay unconscious under the shelf, covered by several tons of rock. What happened over the next 7 hours, I have pieced together from talking with my gang and the rescue team. Elijah was shocked beyond belief. His elation of a few minutes before had turned to complete dismay, yet he hadn't panicked and had sounded the blast warning hooter. 5 prolonged blasts, each interspersed with 15 seconds of silence, then a minute break and a repeat of the same pattern 3 times. There was no mistaking the disaster message. The rest of the gang huddled together in the safety shaft, too shocked to respond, their lives suddenly shattered with the certainty in their minds of their own death should they remain even to help with the rescue. For them, their luck had run out. Their white talisman was dead. It was time to get to the surface, hand in the copper discs which hung around their necks, and get back to the jungle, where in the bright tropical sunlight it was more difficult for death, who saw better in the dark, to find them. Rasputin, working on the main haulage 1/2 mile away, was the first white man to hear the disaster warning. He sent his #1 boy to alert the underground shift boss, and he headed for my grizzly. Frantic with concern, he nevertheless loaded an empty truck with bulkhead timber and instructed his gang to push it to the area of the accident. If it was a grizzly disaster, Rasputin knew the huge slabs of native timber would be needed for any rescue attempt. News of a disaster in the mines spread seemingly by osmosis. Grizzly men who were working the 1,600 feet level with me would close down their grizzlies and bring their gangs in to help. I'd done it myself on 3 occasions, and I knew what it was like when the rescue crews finally pulled the smashed and broken, even sometimes the separated parts of a body from the blood-spattered rock and placed it in a canvas body bag. I'd even seen blood leaking from the pneumatic doors closing the bottom of a grizzly shaft, and had waited the 6 hours it had taken finally to get to the body, which lay only a few feet away, as I did now. It was an unspoken rule that the grizzly men helped in any rescue attempt. They were the personal witnesses to the death with which they had learnt to live every time they climbed the 60 feet of vertical ladder shaft to a grizzly level. The generally unsuccessful rescue attempt was a grim ritual they felt forced to play a part in, out of respect for a dead brother. Rescue procedure is dictated by the environment. A stope and the grizzly below it are a live thing, and have to be silenced before a rescue attempt can be made. The shaft directly above the grizzly bars has to be timbered up, the old bitch silenced. Huge bulk-end timbers, capable of holding back rocks crashing from the stope, were used for this task. Shoring up the grizzly shaft was in itself a dangerous task, particularly as timbermen are not adept at reading a grizzly. The job was complicated by the 20 tons or so of rock which rested on the bars when the hang-up had come down. This would need to be manhandled into the air escape and safety shaft, while the pieces too large to lift would remain on the bars, where they acted as some sort of protection should the bulk-end timbers give way. It was Rasputin's task to build the bulkhead that shored up the shaft above the grizzly. The 10-foot by 10-inch raw native timber slabs, known as 10 by 10s, weighed well over 300 pounds each, and had to be manually pulled up the 60-foot entry shaft to the grizzly level. By the time the rescue crew arrived from the surface, the giant Georgian had already exhausted his own crew, and the crews from the 3 other grizzlies were working turnabout to haul the heavy raw timber. Rasputin worked in a cold, controlled fury, though with no unnecessary movement or wasted energy, speaking quietly to the blacks to keep them from panic. He'd even managed to get my crew back to work. He knew that rescue was a long process made dangerous by hastily contrived directions and the terrible infection of fear. From the grizzly level, he directed the removal of the manageable rock which lay on the tungsten bars. When the rescue captain arrived on the grizzly level, panting from the exertion of climbing the ladders up the entry shaft, Rasputin was waiting for him at the top.
"No come here, PK him mine, I fix."
He glared at the rescue captain, opening and closing his huge fists. The light from the captain's white hat shone into Rasputin's eyes, and held the fury and cold determination. Rasputin was taking no chances. Handing the rescue operation over to the mine captain wasn't going to happen.
Okay, Ruski. I'll send a rigger and an electrician up to give you lights and a rock hoist. You just carry on.
You send Zoran the Croat. I work him.
He turned back to the grizzly. Later, the rescue captain, a man named...